Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence for this Wednesday, July 1st, 2026, in our Macro and AI edition.
Today, we are examining the fundamental shift in global value distribution as compute power replaces capital as the primary driver of sovereign strength. We are moving away from a world defined by liquid reserves toward one defined by hardware density and algorithmic supremacy.
Essentially, the new global arms race is being fought in data centers, not just borders.
So here's the picture: that structural pivot begins with the great AI rebalancing, where the concentration of specialized silicon is rewriting the rules of economic productivity.
$848 billion. That is the current capital expenditure figure for the big cloud players, and it is a number that feels less like a budget and more like a structural shift in the planetary economy. Today we are looking at the great AI rebalancing.
It is a pivot from the visible to the invisible, Maya. We are moving from a period where the headline was simply how many GPUs can you buy to a period where the real value is being extracted from how those GPUs are actually utilized in autonomous workflows.
It sounds a lot like you're saying the era of the big shiny chip is over and we're entering the era of the clever little script.
Not quite, but the focus is shifting up the stack. If you look at the revenue flows, the share coming from the application and model layers has increased nearly threefold over the last year. The market is realizing that the hardware is the foundation, but the actual economic rent is moving toward the software that can actually do something useful.
So the picks and shovels crowd is getting a bit nervous.
There is a distinct rotation happening. Mandeep Singh noted that while the semiconductor rally is driven by massive equipment backlogs, the market is shifting focus from the hyperscalers, the big spenders, to the manufacturers who are actually realizing that revenue. We are seeing a move away from overextended semiconductor and hyperscaler stocks toward sectors that were previously underowned.
I suppose it's hard to stay bullish on a company when their entire growth narrative relies on an unmonetized backlog. It's basically a massive pile of IOUs.
And that is exactly the risk. We are entering a high-stakes monetization phase where that projected $1 trillion in CapEx for next year has to translate into observable revenue, or we face massive demand destruction. But here is the twist: the market isn't necessarily weakening, it is just maturing. We are seeing a divergence in the GPU market where spot prices have fallen 40% from their May peak, yet contract prices are actually rising.
Wait, how does a 40% drop in rental prices lead to higher contract prices? That sounds like a math error.
It's a signal of professionalization. The spot market is for people running opportunistic proof-of-concept experiments, the digital equivalent of renting a car for a weekend. The rising contract prices show that serious buyers are moving toward long-term committed production deployments. They aren't just testing, they are building permanent infrastructure.
So the speculators are leaving and the architects are moving in.
We can trace that further. The architecture itself is changing. We are moving away from simple chat interfaces where you ask a question and get an answer toward agentic workflows. This is a massive multiplier for demand. According to the AI Daily Brief, a single agentic decoding task can consume approximately 1,200 times more tokens than a standard chat interaction. When a model isn't just talking to you, but is instead autonomously researching, iterating, and executing, the compute requirements explode.
Which explains why the power companies are suddenly the most important people in the room.
There's a signal here. The AI Daily Brief also pointed out that this compute supercycle is driving a structural reversal in the U.S. power sector, with annual electricity net generation growth reaching 9 terawatt hours per month. That is a 150% increase over the historical average seen between 2008 and 2024.
It's a lot of pressure to put on the grid. But let's talk about the players. We've been hearing a lot about OpenAI's massive spending, but there's a sense that the great flipping is underway.
There is. We are seeing a great flipping where enterprise customers are increasingly blaming the model, specifically OpenAI's, and switching to Anthropic to achieve a better ROI. Anthropic is executing a much more disciplined strategy. They aren't just chasing raw reasoning power, they are focusing on workflow integration. Take Claude Science, for example. It isn't just a bigger model, it's a specialized workbench with 60 databases designed for reproducibility.
So Anthropic is playing the specialist while OpenAI is playing everything, everywhere, all at once.
And the everything strategy is becoming financially indefensible. There is a growing expectation that OpenAI may have to undergo a great reduction in CapEx and operational expenses during the second half of 2026 just to avoid a liquidity crisis. They are staring down the barrel of a massive valuation drawdown if they cannot prove their aggressive spending can yield a sustainable business model, whereas Anthropic is on a path toward breaking even by 2030.
It's a classic case of the incumbent being crushed by the more agile, specialized competitor. But does this even matter if the models themselves are becoming commodities?
That is the trillion-dollar question. There is a massive movement toward the commoditization of models from companies like OpenAI and Anthropic. As the architecture becomes a commodity, the ultimate economic value shifts to the only thing that can't be easily replicated, proprietary enterprise data.
Which brings us back to the distillation trap. If everyone is training their new models on the outputs of the old models, aren't we just building a house of cards made of recycled paper?
The AI Daily Brief calls it the distillation trap. If companies like Meta try to replace expensive external models with internal systems, they risk contaminating their training data with the outputs of rivals, which could lead to legal exposure and, more importantly, degraded model intelligence. It's a potential feedback loop of mediocrity.
It sounds like a digital version of inbreeding.
It is.
And it's happening alongside a shift in how we even interact with the web. As AI agents become the primary visitors to websites, researching and deciding on behalf of humans, the traditional web faces a structural crisis. Brands are realizing their websites might soon exist solely to be read by bots, not humans.
That's a grim outlook for anyone who spent years on SEO.
It's also a massive opportunity for those who control the agents. You're seeing a move away from text-only prompting toward controllable, agentic workflows with spatial and temporal precision. In the creative industries, the value is shifting from tool mastery, knowing how to use Photoshop or Premiere, to directing agents that can execute a complex, iterative vision.
But there is a darker side to this autonomy. If we are delegating the brain to the machine, what happens to the humans left in the loop?
You get what is being called reverse censorship. The Lawfare podcast describes this as a state where the machine acts as the brain and the human acts as a tool. The human is forced to operate at their absolute physical or mental limit just to avoid becoming the bottleneck in a high-investment, high-speed system.
Which sounds less like empowerment and more like digital sweatshop.
It certainly creates new vulnerabilities. We are seeing the rise of slop squatting, where malicious actors exploit the tendency of AI to predict regular patterns. They create fake software libraries with names that an AI is statistically likely to guess incorrectly, embedding malicious payloads that are virtually indistinguishable from real code during automated processes.
So the more we automate, the more we create these invisible mathematical trapdoors.
And we have to ask if this entire boom is even real in terms of underlying economic growth. Prof. G. Markets recently highlighted that the perceived boom in corporate earnings might be more about accounting than actual scale. In Q1 2026, the massive profits reported by Alphabet, Amazon, and Nvidia were driven significantly by valuation increases in private companies like Anthropic and OpenAI, rather than traditional revenue drivers.
We are essentially looking at a massive, multi-billion dollar upward revaluation of potential rather than performance.
It's a telling detail. When you strip away those private market markups, S&P 500 earnings growth in Q1 2026 was actually around 16%, which is just the standard five-year average. The explosive narrative is largely an illusion created by 12 cents of every dollar in S&P 500 profits stemming from these private valuations.
It's a very expensive illusion. But even if the valuations are inflated, the physical reality of the hardware is harder to ignore. We are seeing older GPUs staying relevant much longer than anyone predicted.
That is a key stabilizer. GPU investment risk is lower than anticipated because older hardware is yielding meaningful returns well into its 7th, 8th, and 9th years, significantly outperforming the standard 6-year depreciation cycle. This provides a productive residue that prevents a total collapse of the ecosystem even if a bubble bursts.
So we aren't heading for a total crash, just a very painful period of repricing the promises versus the products.
It's a structural rebalancing. The money supply might even be shifting toward a new framework where, if these technologies successfully collapse the costs of energy, labor, and materials, we could see massive technological breakthroughs leading to a form of tech-driven deflation.
Investors should start looking at the companies providing the actual physical backbone, like the semiconductor testing and packaging specialists in Malaysia, rather than just the names on the chatbot interface.
The focus has to move to where the actual realized growth is happening.
Enterprise software buyers need to prioritize models with verifiable, reproducible workflows over raw reasoning benchmarks. Keep an eye on the next round of quarterly earnings from the big cloud providers to see if that massive capex is actually translating into new high-margin revenue streams. But this massive-scale automation is also putting a massive strain on the physical world, specifically our ability to keep the lights on. I don't know, Alex, I'm looking at these headlines about the Strait of Hormuz, and I'm thinking we're just overreacting to a classic geopolitical bluff. It's the same old threat in the chokepoint playbook that's been running since the Cold War. Why should anyone actually believe that a localized maritime dispute is going to fundamentally rewrite the global energy architecture or break the back of U.S. shale dominance?
Because this isn't just a standard maritime dispute. We are watching the literal reconfiguration of global supply chains in real time. We're seeing a shift from direct flows to what Bloomberg Surveillance calls a new normal of high-cost ferry service logistics, where tankers are essentially shuttling oil from the strait to waiting vessels in a buffer zone.
Ferry service. That is a lovely sanitized way of saying expensive high-risk maritime shuttle run. It sounds like something a logistics company uses to hide the fact that their insurance premiums just tripled.
It's more than just premiums. The mechanism here is a deliberate timed pressure campaign. Kabir Abu Omar reports that Iranian officials are leveraging a specific 60-day window to implement a new tolling mechanism, using the threat of increased shipping fees as a direct negotiating lever for the upcoming U.S.-Iran talks in Qatar. This isn't just a vague threat, it's a deadline-driven fiscal lever.
Iran is basically trying to implement a subscription model for the Strait. Just wait until the maritime lawyers catch on to the terms and conditions updates.
And it's working on the diplomatic front too. There is a massive structural deadlock emerging because of a disagreement within Oman. While the Sultan agreed to unconditional transit in Paris, the Omani Foreign Ministry has suggested a toll-based service fee during recent meetings in Muscat. If you can't reconcile unconditional transit with a de facto toll system, you can't have a functional negotiation in Qatar.
Which brings us to the real victims. You see all this talk about energy security, but it sounds like the only thing being secured is the profit margin for whoever controls the toll booth. If the U.S. can't guarantee freedom of navigation, why should the heavy hitters stay?
That is exactly the point Ellen Wald argues. The UAE is looking at the math and realizing that if American commitment to maritime security in the Strait wavers, they need a pivot. We are seeing the groundwork for massive infrastructure-led energy independence, specifically building pipelines to bypass the Strait of Hormuz entirely. If the U.S. fails to guarantee the Strait, the UAE moves away from U.S. reliance and toward physical bypasses.
It's a massive if. But even if the Strait goes dark, you've got the U.S. shale machine humming away. I keep hearing this peak oil prophecy, and it feels like every time we get close to a crisis, someone points to an American surplus and tells us everything is fine.
Because the peak oil narrative is fundamentally flawed, it misses the decoupling of NGL growth from crude oil trends. Doomerg noted that we are looking at a massive U.S. shale-driven expansion toward 8 million barrels per day of NGL production. We aren't just talking about crude, we are talking about the massive expansion of natural gas liquids.
Okay, so we have a massive influx of embodied energy that nobody actually knows what to do with.
Something to flag here, Doomerg argues that this NGL oversupply is creating an artificial valuation gap. Right now, propane and butane are priced lower than crude on an energy content basis because the global industrial infrastructure simply lacks the immediate engine capacity to convert this sudden influx of energy into actual work. There is a lag between the supply-side explosion and the downstream demand-side capability.
So we have an abundance of energy that is effectively stranded by a lack of hardware. That sounds like a recipe for a very specific kind of inflation.
It is.
And it's already hitting the central banks. Christine Lagarde noted that the recent ECB interest rate hike in June was a data-driven response to price pressures from the Iran war, rather than a preemptive move against future oil volatility. The supply-side shock is already baked into the inflation print.
And it's not just Europe. The UK is essentially a sitting duck here.
Unhedged points out that the UK's extreme sensitivity to these shocks is driven by a structural inflation-based disadvantage. Because UK inflation was already sitting at 3%, which is higher than the Eurozone, any new supply-side shock from the Middle East triggers much more aggressive shifts in interest rate expectations. Unlike the US, the UK lacks that structural economic shock absorber of being a reserve currency, leaving the sterling and gilt markets uniquely vulnerable to targeted attacks by international investors during periods of fiscal uncertainty.
It's a domino effect. Energy shock hits the UK, inflation spikes, interest rates move, and the currency gets hammered. Meanwhile, the US is sitting there acting as the world's LPG gas station, feeding the demand in places like India.
The pattern is clear. Doomerg highlights that the transition from kerosene to LPG in India is a primary driver for US energy exports. The US shale revolution has positioned America as the world's leading LPG exporter to meet that demand for cleaner burning, distributable hydrocarbons. The war in Iran might be disruptive, but it also acts as a catalyst for energy fungibility, forcing economies to rapidly integrate these new U.S.-centric supply chains.
It's a strange sort of stability, a stability built on high-cost ferries, toll-based diplomacy, and a massive glut of NGLs that we can't yet process. It's less of a global energy market and more of a global energy scramble.
But the pieces are moving. Even the way we trade is changing. Bloomberg Surveillance observes that the ability to transact in U.S. dollars has fundamentally transformed Iranian crude from a sanctioned commodity into a competitive, free-floating market barrel capable of exerting downward price pressure globally. The friction in the Strait creates the volatility, but the dollar-denominated trade creates the liquidity.
So we're watching a world where the geography of the Strait is being bypassed by pipelines in the UAE, while the chemistry of the energy itself, the shift to LPG, is being rewritten by U.S. shale, all while the financial plumbing is being rerouted through the dollar.
It's a complete reconfiguration of the macro landscape.
Investors in the UK gilt market need to recalibrate their hedges against any sudden spike in the Brent prompt. Keep a close eye on the next round of US-Iran discussions in Qatar to see if the toll proposal is officially retracted or formalized. But as the cost of moving physical molecules rises, it makes you wonder how much the cost of moving digital value will change under the weight of this new institutional credit. I think the democratization of private credit is actually just a fancy way of saying we're rebranding institutional risk as a retail feature.
That is a cynical take, Maya, because what we are seeing is a fundamental structural convergence where the lines between public and private markets are physically blurring.
It's just a cycle of, first, we hide the complexity in a wrapper, then we call it access, then we realize the underlying assets are just glorified junk bonds with a better UI.
But look at the mechanics. In the preferred securities market, we're seeing a shift away from bank-dominated landscapes toward utility-led hybrids. As Bob Gingrigorio and Frank Cilio noted, massive capital expenditures for AI and data centers have pushed utility sector hybrid issuance to levels 5 to 6 times higher than bank preferreds. This creates a new class of investor-friendly securities, where the US $1,000 par institutional market now sees corporate hybrids accounting for 35% of the sector.
We're just swapping bank volatility for AI-driven utility debt.
It's more than that, it's about the expansion of the beta enhancer in retail portfolios. The $25 par retail preferred market has moved into a high convexity phase where deep discounts allow for significant price upside. Even the massive T. Rowe Price and Oak Hill Advisors merger is designed to funnel these institutional-grade products, like non-traded BDCs, directly into the wealth channel.
Wait, you're telling me a retiree's target date fund might soon be acting like a high-stakes private equity shop?
The data tells a story through one-stop product tickers. Individual investors can now replicate complex institutional allocations, bypassing K-1 tax complexities and the dreaded capital call periods. As James Reynolds observed, the goal is to blend liquid and private credit to capture value across the spectrum.
It sounds like a way to manufacture a sense of stability while the plumbing gets more complex.
Monetary Matters with Jack Farley flagged that the traditional illiquidity premium is actually vanishing because this massive influx of capital is neutralizing the scarcity that used to justify those high returns.
Pension fund managers will need to rethink their entire liquidity ladder as these liquid private products become the new standard. We'll know if the bubble is holding when we see the first major volatility spike in these new interval funds. But as these markets consolidate, it makes you wonder how much authority is shifting from the courts back to the hands of those running the state. I was looking at my portfolio this morning and realized I can no longer rely on the rules-based order to tell me if a merger is actually happening or if it's just a political favor in disguise.
That's because the regulatory floor is essentially being pulled out from under us. Paul Krugman noted that the Supreme Court's decision in the Slaughter case effectively dismantles the independent agency model by granting the president unilateral authority to fire commissioners, neutralizing the statutory protections that kept bodies like the FTC from being captured by partisan interests.
The FTC isn't an independent referee anymore, it's just another player on the field, subject to whatever the White House feels like on a Tuesday.
The implication runs deeper. This expansion of the unitary executive theory creates what Krugman calls a shameful shakedown environment. The mechanism is direct. The president gains the power to approve or withhold regulatory favors, like merger clearances, which can then be used as a tool for political coercion or to reward campaign donors.
It's like moving from a game of chess to a game of whoever the president likes most wins the piece.
It's actually more structural than that. The recent judicial trend toward a structural constitution represents a shift from executing established laws to a model where the president can circumvent congressional intent by replacing nonpartisan experts with loyalists. We're seeing the executive branch transformed into a vehicle for personalist rule.
Wait, are you telling me the major questions doctrine is basically a surgical tool for the court to pick and choose which parts of the government to dismantle?
The court has used that doctrine to block climate mitigation in West Virginia v. EPA, yet it remains conspicuously unapplied to Trump's own more expansive executive actions. Krugman argues the Roberts Court is acting as a kingmaker, using its discretionary docket to selectively choose cases that facilitate executive power expansion while ignoring precedents that could check it.
This is getting a bit too much like a legal thriller for my taste.
The real danger is the shift from predictable, ideological governance to personalist governance, where regulatory decisions are driven by the arbitrary whims or personal grievances of a single leader, undermining the stability required for global investment.
Global institutional investors will have to recalibrate their risk models for U.S. regulatory approvals immediately. Keep an eye on the next round of FTC merger denials to see if they align with political donor lists rather than antitrust precedent. But if the very foundations of the state are becoming this unpredictable, how much can we actually trust the underlying code of our new decentralized financial systems? Alex, if the goal of digital money is to make life easier, Why does the architecture of the Ethereum ecosystem currently feel like trying to move liquid through a series of disconnected, leaking pipes?
It's because we're seeing a massive friction gap in how assets actually move. As Unchained noted, Ethereum's native asset, ETH, suffers from a lack of interoperability compared to assets like USDC, which can teleport via CCTP. This friction prevents ETH from being a first-class citizen in decentralized markets.
We have a teleporting dollar but a stranded ETH. That sounds less like a global financial revolution and more like a very expensive logistical headache.
It gets more complex when you look at the macro layer. The big view argues that the distinction between regulating stablecoins as investment vehicles versus means of payment is the critical regulatory pivot point. The latter requires significantly more stringent backing to maintain the fundamental singleness of money. If we can't achieve that one-one redeemability, we can't have wholesale finance.
Right, because if my digital dollar fluctuates in value against a real dollar every time there's a spike in network traffic, I'm not holding money, I'm holding a very volatile, very small tech stock.
Two things stand out, and there is a structural paradox at play here. As transaction volume increases, the computational cost and fees rise, leading to congestion effects that inherently limit the network effects necessary for a currency to be widely accepted. To fix this, we need to move away from fragmented bridges toward a single shared settlement layer acting as a core substrate, allowing customized, application-specific chains to interact with frictionless, trustless interoperability.
It's quite a lovely vision, a single unified ledger where central bank money and digital assets just coexist in perfect, frictionless harmony. I suppose it's only a small step away from total financial utopia.
We aren't there yet. The BIS and Reuters Breaking Views have been discussing the unified ledger concept as a way to integrate tokenized central bank money and commercial deposits, but the technical risks, like network congestion and the difficulty of implementing KYC in unhosted wallets, remain massive hurdles.
Central bank regulators will need to finalize the interoperability standards for the unified ledger before any significant commercial deposit migration begins. Watch for the next round of U.S. Treasury updates on the Genius Act to see if the legislative framework for stablecoin backing actually tightens. As we wrap up this July 1st edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today is a fundamental migration of value. We are witnessing a structural move away from the physical and the capital-heavy toward the computational and the algorithmic. Whether it is the rotation from GPU hardware toward the high-margin application layers, or the shift from centralized maritime trade to decentralized domestic energy production, the world is trading bulk and scale for complexity and precision.
Worth noting, the cross-cutting implication here isn't just about market volatility. It's about the changing calculus for the C-suite at firms like Anthropic or the heavyweights in the U.S. energy sector. For these decision makers, the primary risk has shifted from how much capital can we deploy to how efficiently can we manage density. Success no longer depends on owning the most infrastructure, but on mastering the orchestration of massive, token-heavy agentic workflows and navigating a fragmented, high-cost energy landscape. If you cannot translate your massive capital expenditure into verifiable high-margin revenue streams, especially as the software layers begin to capture a much larger slice of the total revenue pie, you aren't building an empire, you're just inflating a bubble.
It's a high-stakes game of efficiency where the margin for error is shrinking as the complexity of the underlying assets grows.
Keep a close eye on the next round of quarterly cloud CapEx reports. If we see that $848 billion in spending continuing to climb without a corresponding spike in downstream application revenue, it will confirm that we are still in a period of speculative revaluation rather than a true era of computational productivity.
That's the signal to watch. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow for the Tech and Biotech Edition.